Hey, Deep Fried fans. Today, Keith and Woody sit down with Sean Wildermuth and take a practical look at using Silverlight. Sean Wildermuth is a Microsoft MVP in C#. He is also a speaker on the INETA Speakers Bureau and has appeared at several national conferences to speak on a variety of subjects. He is also the author of several books, including PragmaticADO.net for Addison Wesley, and is also the co-author of 4 Microsoft Certification Training Kits for MS Press, as well as the upcoming book, Prescriptive Data Architectures. Sean is currently teaching Silverlight across the country during his Silverlight tour. More information is available at www.silverlight-tour.com. Okay, Deep Fried fans, grab that glass of sweet tea and get ready for some Gumpology.
Welcome back, folks, to Deep Fried Bites.
Yeah, welcome everyone. Hey, Keith, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, man. I had a long weekend. What about yourself?
Oh, I had a great weekend. Had family in town. Went to Detroit Tigers baseball game today with my boys, so it was a really good weekend.
Good. I've been doing the checking things off the honey-do list myself, and got a few of those off. And in honor of the Olympics, Saturday, I mowed my yard in Olympic record time, so I received a gold medal for myself.
I think I have the Olympic gold medal for the longest grass, so in the same thing, I have to mow tomorrow, so it is pretty deep, so it's going to be Olympic task just in itself.
Well, I'd gotten to the point where I was actually scared to go turn off my water faucet from the fear of seeing a snake in my grass around the house. My weeds are growing up so much. I got a big riding lawnmower and I can't get around the side of the house, like in between the trees in the house. So I have to weed eat that, and I don't weed eat it all the time. And it literally had rained every day in the last 6 or 7 days. So it was really tall.
Well, you're pampered, man. You have a riding lawnmower. I still have a push with it's totally me powered, pushing lawnmower. It's not self powered. So,
okay. Well, now hang on now. I've got a 4-foot John Deere, but I have 1.5 acres to mow. And just for the record, I have push mowed this freaking yard. And it only takes, about 7 hours to mow it with a push mower. So
no, I believe you. Mine only takes, I think I'm at about a little over, about a third of an acre. So, it only takes me about an hour and a half to mow.
Well, it takes me an hour and a half to mow with the riding lawnmower in fifth gear with turbo on. I mean, that's like humping it out across the yard. I mean, my wife says, she goes, whenever you mow the yard, it's like a race car driver. You just come wheeling around the house, just, and you're gone.
Well, that's because you don't want to do it. So if you're like me, I mowed yards. When I was 12, I started mowing yards like probably 20, 30 in a week, every week, and I hate mowing.
I don't mind the mowing. It's just, if what I like to do is time the mowing to where it's after a rain, like the same day of a rain or the day after. That way all the dust and stuff doesn't get, thrown up as much. So then I don't mind it. But if I have to mow like in July where it doesn't rain in a month, then it sucks really bad.
Yeah, this brings up, we should do a John Deere technology podcast. That would be really cool, wouldn't it?
Technology in the yard, or maybe?
Yeah, maybe one of those robots. They have those vacuum cleaner robots that automate the vacuuming of your house. They actually have a
The iRobots.
They have a robot now that mows your yard. I need one of those.
Get out of here.
No, they have one.
Really?
Yeah, Google it or MS Live search it.
Or Cool It, whatever that new search engine.
Oh, that sucks, man. No, I tried that out. I tried that out on myself, and I got there was not one picture, even though it found some stories, maybe some blog stuff, the pictures that it put were like of totally different people.
I searched on it, and I got like weird things back that were not even really remotely related to me whatsoever. Like my actual blog, KeithElder.net, wasn't even on the page. I'm like, what is going on? had some weird stuff on there from like 1997.
Exactly. I was about to say, I had some, I think my original podcast, not my original, well, my original podcast, which was Tech Quick, and I think it also picked up this old Delphi blog that I did years ago, so, but it never picked up a Cloud Socket. So I think they're 12 billion page kind of, what do you call it? Page, the links or that they ran through were, really old. They must have been working off of a 2002, snapshot of the internet.
Maybe they just used a Wayback Machine from 2002 and back, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, speaking of the Olympics, we are talking about Silverlight with Sean Wildermuth, and we're going to kick into part two here. So I think we're going to get into some of the Silverlight stuff with the Olympics and have a discussion around that with Sean. So, Mr. Woody, are you ready for part two of Silverlight with Sean Wildermuth?
Yeah, I am. I am. I'm excited after last week's show to get into this one.
Yeah, this one's actually a little bit better than the first one. We got off to a kind of a slow start, sort of like in the Olympics, and then we made a lot of ground up here in the second half. So, okay, folks, thanks for tuning in for today's show, and here comes Sean with Silverlight.
So, Sean, so for our listeners out there, can we convert our old VB6, MFC, Delphi, and newer applications like WinForms, can we convert those easily over to Silverlight?
No, it's a complete rewrite. Two reasons. One, mostly those applications have direct access to enterprise-level resources like databases, and so you would need to have some way to communicate that across a web server to get at that information, web services or otherwise. And the other is the design model. The way you design pages in Silverlight and WPF is dramatically different, though a lot more powerful than you could in those older technologies. So you're talking about taking an application and rewriting it pretty much whole to convert it to Silverlight. And again, if it's an enterprise app, I don't suggest necessarily going to Silverlight. You may decide to go to WPF if you want some more of the skinning or shininess of newer applications. But it's still a complete rewrite. There's no good story there. The only caveat there is if you're in WinForms, if you're already in managed code, you can reuse some of your business logic if it's separated from your UI. If you're using business objects or CSLA or something to separate that, you can reuse some of that because it is still .NET code, but it's not a all the UI needs to be rewritten, ground up completely.
Wow, it's like, okay, what are we going to use Silverlight for then, Sean?
I really think Silverlight's use is to extend the web app model. I have an application that has certain functionalities, and I want to make something that extends it. The graph example we talked about earlier is a good example. I've got a business application that I want to be able to show some real-time graphing of the stock price or the number of downtime at oil and gas wells or whatever the case may be. I may continue to have a lot of my application in HTML and ASP.NET or whatever web technology you're using, but have the specialized part of my application that is doing something richer, doing something more real-time communication with the server, doing more graphing, more, much of what can be done in Silverlight, if you ignore the kind of vector graphic story, can be done in Ajax, but there's a... there's a learning curve. If I'm taking an ASP.NET programmer who has done mostly server-side code, running Silverlight's a lot easier than getting into the Ajax stuff. Even though the Ajax libraries make it easier, it's still a different world.
I mean, if I had to break it down and say, I need to put this in some short, concise, terms, I would say if you're looking at Silverlight for internal applications, you should rethink
Correct.
That. If you're looking at building a complete website on Silverlight, you may want to rethink that. You want to, you still are going to have HTML around the outside. I think you used the word Chrome on the outside of it. And Silverlight can be sprinkled into your website in certain areas and sort of like a pepper and a salt and a stew there. And you can sprinkle that in and make things shiny and sparkly and cute and all that fun stuff.
But if you're building real applications, if you're building, you know, an interface between, there's a good example out there of Microsoft's has a medical example where people are using across outside of the firewall a way to, you know, look at radiology reports. So in a lot of cases where companies have outsourced their radiology departments to India or Mexico or Indiana, they could use Silverlight to develop an application to look at that stuff. And Silverlight could apply things like deep zoom to provide an easy way to look at things like radiology reports or to cardiologists to look at EKGs and things like that. If you're going across the wire, it's still a business app, and Silverlight can do some really amazing things for you. And it may even be a full-page app that is going to exist on a single page inside your website. Just don't rewrite your entire website as one giant zap file. That's where I think people are going to be most pained.
Right. Well, like I remember the Silverlight demo from AOL's, mm-hmm. you know, mail client from Mix, and I thought that was a really cool Silverlight 2.0 demo. I really
but
did.
You're not going to replace all of AOL with one app that does mail and bulletin boards and chat rooms and all of that. You're not going to create one app that does them all. You may create a number of them that have different functionalities on different URIs, on different destination pages. That's what I want to try to get people out of. Because when you come from WinForms or you come from desktop development inside the enterprise, you run an executable that has 14 different functions in it. Think of an accounting system. And people, when they're looking at Silverlight, they're thinking of one Silverlight app that has these 14 facilities in them. If you really need that across the firewall, you may decide to build, you know, one application for accounts receivable, one for payroll, one for, and they exist on different pages in a web application. But you're never going to write one giant app. It's the monolithic app that's the problem.
I think that's I think that's some good guidance there, or some good comments that may help some people.
And the longer Silverlight's out there, the more best practices we'll have. What we have now is, you know, based on what we've seen done out there, what hasn't worked and what has been painful.
Earlier, Sean, you mentioned Silverlight training. What are some of the aha moments that you've had with students whenever they get to learning the technology and start getting hands-on with it?
Well, there's really two things that happen pretty much every class. The first thing that usually happens on the first day is that someone has come to my class with the idea of rebuilding some large monolithic application all in Silverlight. And they've taken, you know, some VB6 app like we've been talking about, and they want to rewrite, you know, it entirely as one giant Silverlight app. And they're confused in why I'm dissuading them from that story. Sometimes it takes them a couple of days to kind of get their head around it to where they can certainly use Silverlight to augment it and to move towards building their web app, but that they're not going to simply take an existing app and make one giant zap file out of it. The other common story is when we start talking to users on the third day about data binding and data. So we show them actually getting data from a server and showing the rich binding story of Silverlight. For users that haven't used WPF, their first view into the data binding story in Silverlight is very aha. If you've used data binding ASP.NET, if you've used it in WinForms, the Silverlight and WPF data binding story is very organic and very natural. It has this notion of binding to simple objects without a whole lot of necessary interfaces implemented. It also has this notion of that controls have a relationship to each other. So as you bind a sectional controls on a form, if they have related information, you don't have to write a lot of terse code to make sure that binding happens. And so, you know, I get a lot of people after that third day going, wow, I wish I could do this in my desktop app, or I wish I could do this in ASP.NET, because it's such an organic thing to see.
So talking about the training that you do with Silverlight, you talk about showing teaching people how to get data from some repository in the back end. But can you tell us how hard it is to use data in Silverlight and maybe some of the ways that people can
well,
access
there's two
data?
Basic idea. There's two different ideas. I'll talk about each of them separately. I'll first talk about how it gets data. And because Silverlight is meant to be used on a web page, the way it gets data is by going to a web server and requesting data. So that means that using web services or REST APIs to get at data is what it very naturally does. So Silverlight has an integration to work with simple web services, really anything with a WSDL file, or WCF services, though it has some limitations to what it can do with WCF. There's also something new coming out in .NET 3.5 SP1 called ADO.NET Data Services. And Data Services is a way to expose a link, an object model that supports link across port 80, as it were. It has the ability to not only expose data, but also consume updates so that I can, from the Silverlight code, I can write a link query that goes out across the wire, makes a request, update that data, and then make the updates across the wire as well without writing an awful lot of code. It really takes a lot of what Link supports and exposes it over a REST API.
Yeah. That, you know, ADO.NET Data Services, or as I like to call it when I talk to people, because I do talk on that to like local user groups and stuff, but it's called Astoria. So I always say, forget about ADO.NET Data Services. I'm going to call it Astoria still. So, but Astoria is a very cool product. And I could see where it can really fit and allow Silverlight to do things very easily and quickly.
So a question on that. Do you think Microsoft created ADO.NET Data Services because of Silverlight, or did it just get evolved and grew out of something and then they just plugged it in with Silverlight?
Both, really. I think it was really envisioned originally to support the same sort of facility for Ajax, because it's a way to get at data, and there's actually an Ajax library that works with it to do the same sorts of things. And then when Silverlight came along, they decided to write something where you could execute link in the browser, have it go across the REST interface, and then eventually execute link on the server against any linkable data source. And the any linkable data source is the important story here, because it's not tied to Entity Framework. It's not tied to Link to SQL. I've got an example out there where it's working against Nhibernate's Link implementation. It works against any data source that supports Link, so LLBL, Gen Pro, and I'm sure most of the ORMs are going to support Link any day now. So any linkable data source. The other half of the story I wanted to talk about was consuming data. Once you get data in through web services, REST, or ADO.NET data services, you're going to consume them as .NET objects or as XML. And because Link is supported in Silverlight, shaping and filtering and sorting and all that sort of thing can be done directly in Silverlight by using Link or any other method you want. But Link is a very natural way to do that, so that you can go ahead and data bind. And as sorting has changed or filtering or even shaping of the data, you can do all that in the client without having to go back to the server to get a new, you know, version of the same data you've already loaded.
So what's the, you know, being a smart client guy for a long time, what's the story with, you know, storing memory and caching and stuff in Silverlight? I mean, you're going to pull back, you know, let's take like the AOL email example earlier, right? They're pulling back a bunch of email messages. What do you do with that? I mean, does it stay in memory in the browser? You cache it? I mean, what's the story there, Sean?
Well, you have a couple of different options. You can actually, there is a place in isolated storage. And if you're familiar with smart client work, you've probably worked with isolated storage
before.
Sure,
absolutely.
Same story in Silverlight. You can save, it's a quoted area of the disk, and you can actually ask the user for more storage if you need it. So you can do local stores of data as well. One of the differences between Smart Client and Silverlight is that you are in the memory space of the browser. So as you use more memory, the browser is using more memory. As the browser goes away, your memory goes away. So just being aware that you're in the shared space is an important distinction that you end up learning pretty quickly.
So, I mean, it's sort of the same. It sounds like it's close to the same scenario. I mean, I don't want my Smart Client eating up 500 megs of, you know, memory.
Correct.
You don't want the browser doing that either. And if you need to, you know, pull some stuff and then, you know, cache some stuff locally, you can cache with Silverlight. So that's actually a really good story, I think.
You can. It, And in the story of the AOL email, you also have to be as smart as a developer. You're not going to pull down the 4,000 messages they have. You may pull down header information to show a grid of the 50 messages that could be on the screen, and then maybe make a web request and cache messages as they view them, or expire caches. I mean, you still have to write smart code.
Sure. Yeah, you got to make it intelligent. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the browser, the browser stack data is going through HTTP and HTTPS and stuff like that, and web service and RESTful stuff. You know, we have Windows Communication Foundation, or WCF for short. I'm going to probably answer my own question here, the fact that you can't use a lot of the really cool bindings with WCF. You can't use like the net bindings, but you can use, the other supported HTTP protocol bindings, I guess, right?
Today, the only binding that's supported for Silverlight is basic HTTP binding. That's the only one. And mostly it's because some of the other more complex bindings are using envelope information or WSI headers to contain things like authorization information and containing authentication information. And because Silverlight is living in the browser, and anyone with a memory browser or that wants to grab the zap file and use Reflector to look at it, it's very hard to do things like shared secrets on both ends of the wire. Whereas WCF was really envisioned that you can control both sides of the wire, and so you can do some very sophisticated things. Silverlight, could be a security vector if they allowed all of that. So they've decided to only support a subset of what WCF can do.
And the only thing that they support is basic, you said?
Basic HTTP binding. So binding over port 80 or port 443. No TCP, no MSMQ or any of the other
MSMQ binding. Stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, none of that's going to be supported. There is often neglected in the discussions of Silverlight, but there is actually a socket stack. So if you needed real-time communication with your server, you could use sockets. They have to be TCP, but there is another way of getting information. Socket work is kind of hardcore. If you really need it, the support is there, but I don't expect that most applications will use it. But you can imagine writing a chat client between two instances of a browser that could go through a back-end server so that you could have real-time communication.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So for our listeners out there, they're sitting down and they're getting some requirements from maybe a business analyst or a superior or their manager, and they have to do maybe a website and maybe some pages of a web application. I mean, should they use Silverlight, or what would your suggestion be for them?
My suggestion is that you should use Silverlight where it's going to make the experience better. One of the problems with developers, and I'm certainly guilty of this, is sometimes I want to use the new shiny thing because it's new. And if you're going to do things that need like real-time communication with the server, or you want to do some rich vector graphics or shiny animations in like a menu system, something like that, Silverlight can do a great job. But doing some basic functionality like navigation or switching between rendering of a blog, for instance, that doesn't make any sense for Silverlight, and so I really dissuade people from overusing it. Hopefully we can learn from the Flash guys, because when Flash first came out, everybody who touched Flash did everything they could in Flash. Everything, we can do it in Flash, therefore we should. And I'm hoping that as a developer community, we can learn from that.
We're only a couple days before the Summer Olympics in China. And I know NBC and Microsoft have a big partnership with using Silverlight to stream a lot or all of the Olympics across the internet through Silverlight apps. What do you think the impact is for Silverlight and possibly for Microsoft around the Olympics?
Well, I think the Olympics are a great opportunity for Microsoft. One of the things it will do, I think, is get Silverlight on a lot of desktops. One of the battles between, Flash and Flex and Silverlight is ubiquity. Flex and the Flash runtime exists on so many boxes automatically. Even many built machines come with it pre-installed that getting the runtime pre-installed is a big deal, and I think the Olympics will do a great measure of getting it on a lot of boxes. It'll help with the ubiquity story. The problem with it is I think it's high risk. They're showing so much video through Silverlight that if there's a failure in the back end to keep up with the capacity, I think it's going to be blamed on Silverlight. I've been asked this question before, and as I've stated before, if there's a problem or a glitch with getting the video to end users, to consumers, that's going to be the big Mary Jo story the next day, that Silverlight failed, not that Windows Media Services wasn't scaling properly or that there was a glitch because a boat ran over a cable connection between Beijing and the mainland. It's that Silverlight failed in some reason. So I think there's, you know, they're taking a big risk, but the reward is pretty big as well. I think it's only going to be a pass-fail. There's no such thing as a C in this. They either have to hit a home run or strike out.
I would suspect that they're really going to try to make this a good win and really put some serious oomph behind all of that bandwidth and pipes and everything, you know, that they're going to be pushing out that much video. So.
I expect that to be true. I mean, it's impressive that they're going to be showing every moment of every event through Silverlight. Every moment of every event. That's a pretty big undertaking. And I also believe that's why the Silverlight RTM is slated to be delivered after the Olympics. The main idea there for me is that they wanted the ability to change things to accommodate the Olympics, you know, up through the Olympics. So instead of having a firm runtime that everyone was running on, they wanted the ability to, if they had to change something before release, that they could.
Yeah, that gives them ability to, you know, the devs at NBC call and go, look, guys, we found this bug, and they can patch it and fix it, you know, or change something right then and there.
Absolutely.
And make the experience better. Makes sense. Well, Woody, we got a new sponsor this week called DevExpress. You ever heard of them?
I've heard of them. I use them.
Me too. I use CodeRush a lot.
Yeah, I use Refactor Pro a lot, but I also use CodeRush a lot. I use them both.
You know what never fails when I go out and I speak someplace, and I do a presentation, and then I go out and mingle with the crowd. People always say, how did you write that stuff so fast? And I say, well, I use CodeRush to code all the objects and all the classes and everything with. And that's when people actually see somebody using it, like, you know, in a real environment. That's when they really start to actually get it, that it will increase their productivity.
Exactly. And all the keystrokes that it will save you and just the time. For the price, it's a small price to pay for giving you such power at your fingertips.
Absolutely. You know, they also make ASP.NET tools and controls, as well as WinForm controls as well. So, you know, guys, if you haven't checked them out, go out there and give them a whirl. $250 for CodeRush and Refactor. I mean, you'll get that back in a few days once you learn the product.
Exactly.
Thanks again to DevExpress for supporting the show. Okay, Sean, I got a little rusty washer segment for us here.
Great.
So for those that don't know, we do a little what we call shiny pennies and rusty washers on Deep Fried Bites. For those that have ever seen a demo on a new product or a new piece of technology, it looks all shiny and everything until you get back to the office and then you try to use it and you start finding these rusty washers in it. So, Sean, tell us some rusty washer stories with Silverlight.
Well, I'll talk about the one that I think gets the most interest from developers, and that is the problem with asynchronous communication. In Silverlight, every web request that is made has to be asynchronous. There's no way to make a synchronous web service call with Silverlight. Everything has to be asynchronous. Now, the reason for this, I think, is actually good. And it's interesting, some of the people that are complaining haven't had or haven't spent a lot of time dealing with making asynchronous requests. And I think once they get used to it, it's pretty organic. The reason it's a big deal is we're living in a shared space. Silverlight, unlike your desktop app, is living in the process that your web browser does, that the rest of the web page and that every tab in that browser is living in. It's a single process. So that if I block the main thread because I'm doing a synchronous request that is delayed, the user can't close the application, can't switch tabs, can't do anything. They're just stuck. And the way that Silverlight handles that is forcing you to make all web requests as being asynchronous so that there's no blocking done of the main thread. So it's a rusty washer in that there's some additional pain for developers to get used to, but after they've done it once or twice, it becomes pretty much rote. And in fact, you know, for desktop development, it's a smarter way to go anyway.
Sure. I mean, you don't want your application to lock up and look like the applications that we've all used for years.
Correct.
That lock up is why we're using them.
Or appear. And the other problem here is if a naive developer did block the thread, it again would be that page one Mary Jo story the next day that Silverlight is causing browser lockups all over the place, even though it may be that someone was going to their slow server and taking 30 seconds to retrieve, you know, an enormous piece of data from some test server. So it's also, I think, a bit of a buffer to make sure that Silverlight maintains its good name.
You know, that reminds me of a story. I was doing some .NET development the other day, and I was training some people that all they've really done for a long time is really just mainframe development, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were writing just a simple console app just to test some, you know, just some regular C#, you know, code loops or generic or something like that. And we ran the demo, and it popped up, you know, with an exception error. And we debugged down into it and said, oh, well, we were doing something stupid here. And about two or three of the people went, oh, so all of those errors that are happening aren't Windows' fault. That's actually the developer's fault. And I went, yeah, this is why people say sometimes that Windows is bad. It's not Windows' fault. It's the developer's fault writing the software. So,
or the
let's
driver.
Make that clear. Let's understand that. What else you got, Rusty Washer size? Or Rusty Washers for us, Sean?
One of the issues that pains people as well is that Silverlight is in a very secure sandbox, and so you can't get at a lot of things you might expect. So there's two issues here. One is a security sandbox. You can't get at local resources. You can't get at microphones or webcams or USB or local drives, really, almost in any fashion. There's a couple of ways where the user could pass you a file stream, but for the most part, you can't go looking at file structures at all. That's a good thing.
Now, Flash can. Will that change, you know, down the road for us, or what?
I'm sure that the USB story will change to support things like webcams and microphones. In Flash, it's a very opt-in. You can't do it by default. You have to ask the user. The user has to give you permission to do it and give permission to this specific app. And I think it'll be the same story here. It also is missing some of the .NET framework that people might be used to. The biggest thing that pains some people is the lack of a printing subsystem. Currently, if you want to print what is shown in a Silverlight app, you press print and let the browser print it. And that, for most people, that's an awful story.
So we've got, so far we've got asynchronous stuff. We've got local resources. How many more you got?
A few more. There is actually one really bad one that is mostly an issue with Silverlight. And I don't see it getting fixed, but it's something to realize. Relative URIs, when you're using them inside of Silverlight, whether you're going to get an image file or whether you're going to get a video file, anything that you can define in a URI inside the XAML itself, inside the design markup, has its own set of rules for how those relative URIs are defined. Those are different from when you're going to make a web request or other requests. In fact, they're different enough that there's no way to... they're different enough that the URIs are actually relative to where the Silverlight app exists, not where the web page exists. And this is a very interesting story because the reason they have a special path is because when I ask for a relative path of images/foo.jpg, the first place it looks is inside my application's zap file, that zip file that the whole application exists. And then it falls back to the web server. When it falls back to the web server, it has to look where the zap exists. So if you're using a zap from another web server, not from the one that is hosted for the web page, you'll never be able to get it exists on that web server that the page was requested from. So it really lives in the world of where did my Silverlight app come from, not where my web page that my Silverlight app is hosted on came from. Now, it wouldn't be too bad if we had one set of rules. Unfortunately, for anything else, for web requests, for web service calls, for retrieval of simple files and stuff from the web server, they use the traditional method because they're using the network stack of the browser itself. So when I say /foo.webresource, it's going to go to the web server's root path and look for that resource. So for developers, it's a pain to think about them as two different code paths for what looks like the same URI scheme.
So one works one way, one works the
correct.
Other.
Do you think the Silverlight product team will obscure that one way?
No. They have a reason for doing this, and it's really to maintain compatibility with WPF. I don't like their answer, but I understand it. I actually have a web post about it a couple months ago that kind of explained why they're doing it, and so I don't think they're going to give in. I don't think it's the right thing to do, but they do, so... That's why I don't get a blue badge, and they do.
You know, I've heard a lot that they spend a lot of time with the WPF and the Silverlight compatibility. So I would think you're right. They're probably not going to give in, and I mean, I'd rather have the compatibility myself than have to, you know. Just once you learn it, you've learned it, and you learn how to work around it. I'm okay with that. You know, as long as I know going in. So.
Well, for all the WPF guys out there, there's something called the PAC URI syntax. That when you're learning WPF is a pretty painful because it's talking about getting resources from the assemblies themselves and from the package. What the Silverlight guys wanted to do was avoid you having to think about it. And so even though this isn't the best way to handle it, it's better than actually the way the WPF guys had to handle it. So I'll give them a kudos. They're better off than WPF was, but I'm still not satisfied because I'm me.
Yeah, that's a much harder story with the package of WPF,
yeah.
No doubt. So now, Sean, I heard there were some rusty washers with deployment. What do you know about that?
Well, when you're developing a typical web application, you have a number of different assets. You have JavaScript files and image files and other things that you may be part of an existing web page. And the same is true for Silverlight. The problem is that with typical web page development, those items are cached individually. So that if I request the same JavaScript file on three different pages, it actually uses the browser cache to retrieve those separately so that web pages can load faster if, let's say, you have a large JavaScript file that's reused, like msajax.js, which is used on a number of pages. In Silverlight, the problem is that as you add components, as you add assemblies, whether it's ones that you've written or third parties like Infragistics or Telerik or one of those guys, you have to include them in your application. And so there's no caching of those. If three pages use that same DLL, it's going to be downloaded on every page separately. Now, the ZAP files are going to be cached, but there's no notion of a Silverlight GAC, if people are familiar with the global assembly cache. There's no sense of reusing them across application. And that's a pain problem for some people because they want to make their ZAP files, those things that are downloaded across the wire, as small as possible.
Okay, so if I replay that back to you, if I have three Silverlight applications on one domain, and I use a particular third party assembly like DevExpress or Infragistics or Telerik or something like that, and I put that into the ZAP file or my application needs it, it's in three separate ZAP files, and so whenever that person or that viewer hits those three applications, it's going to get downloaded by the ZAP. So therefore, there's technically three copies, on their machine.
Correct. Correct.
And that's just sort of the way that the deployment works because
correct.
It's really you're downloading a package.
Yeah.
There is no way to say, take this assembly, put it here, and track the versions and whatever.
And you can do some things if you decide to, in the background, download assemblies and load them, but the story isn't very good for dynamic assembly downloads today. The other issue there is often IT departments don't want to open up to download .dll files for some very obvious reasons. So most Silverlight applications are going to include them in their ZAP instead of downloading them separately anyway. I think that story will get better over time, but today it's not a terribly terrific story.
I mean, I don't think it's terribly bad. I mean, is there a particular Is there a particular use case where this is a bad thing?
Well, yes. In Silverlight, there's actually two sides. There's the SDK and there's the plugin. And the plugin contains a bunch of assemblies that are pre-installed on the machine when they install the plugin. And most of the controls in Silverlight exist in the plugin. One of the controls that doesn't is the data grid. And the data grid is one of the larger controls, which is why they didn't include it by default. They didn't think it would be used on every single page. It's about a quarter of a meg in size, the assembly. So if I have five pages that all use the data grid, my zap files are going to be enlarged by that three quarters of a meg, even in a holo world. So that there's no way for it to reuse that assembly, even though I'm using it on every page or multiple pages. So it's just going to make the startup of that particular page slower.
Do you think the Silverlight team knows that that's a rusty washer, and do you think they'll do anything about it in the future?
I think they will, because there's actually two problems here. One is the deployment story for the end users, and it's also a pain point for the third-party developers, because there's currently no way to protect those assets either from people just stealing the assemblies and using them. Both of those problems, I think, will be solved with the same solution, and that is some way to defer that and authorize that retrieval of those assemblies after load. Maybe something like a zap file manifest that says, go get these assemblies from these places asynchronously or slowly, so that if it goes through the browser cache, if it goes through the browser's network stack, it'll be involved in the cache. And if it's cached, as long as you're getting the same URI in both cases, you'll benefit from the cache. I don't think there'll ever be something like a GAC, but you can get something similar to that by using browser cache.
So, Sean, kind of wrapping things up, tell us about this, the Silverlight tour that you have kind of mentioned, and how can people get information on that and some other training that you do?
Sure. The Silverlight tour is a 3-day workshop that I give on Silverlight. I give most of the classes. I have a second instructor starting soon that will be giving some of the classes, so I don't want to promise people that I'll be at every class, but for the most part, I'm teaching most of the classes. We teach it throughout the United States. We also have partners that teach it in Canada in English and French. We just announced a partner in Mexico that's going to be teaching it in Latin America and Spain in Spanish. And really, it's a 3-day workshop. It's geared towards developers, though we always get some designers that benefit from the first couple of days. And as we start to talk about the server story, get a little lost. So I don't want to promise it's really designed for designers. It's not. The important part of the tour is that we teach developers a lot of the nooks and crannies. We don't necessarily teach them syntax beginning to end. The intention is to give them the breadth of what is Silverlight so they can go home, and as they start to use different pieces, they'll have exposure to those. And that's everything from designing with Blend to control skinning and writing your own controls to writing backend services and integrating data. So we really try to do soup to nuts for developers in this course. You can get information about the course at silverlight-tour.com. It includes a pretty Silverlight map, and you can see everywhere where we're holding the course and register and all of that. Thanks for asking.
Well, Sean, I appreciate you coming on today's show.
Thank you for having me.
I do, too. Thank you.
It's been a ball.
You've given us a heck of a whirlwind tour of a lot of things about Silverlight. We've covered Flex and Flash and Linux, OS X, and rusty washers and zap files. Oh, and
the Olympics.
The Olympics. I mean, we've done a whole bunch of stuff, so really appreciate your time today.
It's a great, been a ball.
Well, we hope to get you back on someday. So if you ever have any new material on Silverlight, just let us know. And I know you've been playing with some other things too lately. So what, just real quick, what are some of your other interests that you've been doing, that you've been dabbling
in? Well,
I've
been looking at a lot of DSL-like things. I've been looking at Boo and looking at more dynamic language stuff to see whether it fits into some of the stuff I care about. You know, my world has primarily been about the data. I care about what's the middle tier, not necessarily with how it's stored in SQL Server or what it looks like when it's displayed, but what happens in between those two. And so there's been a lot of discussion lately and consternation about things like the entity framework and and data. So I like to get in those fist fights when I can.
keep your axes sharp.
Absolutely,
on that,
huh? Absolutely.
Well, thanks again, Sean. We certainly appreciate it, Mr. Woody. It was a pleasure talking to you again. I'm sure we'll be chatting soon.
Oh, we will.
Okay, folks, that's another episode of Deep Fried Bites. We certainly appreciate you tuning in. As always, you can send us comments at comments@deepfriedbites.com. You can also reach us on Twitter at Twitter/deepfriedbites, all one word. And we also have a Facebook group out there. If you're on Facebook, just connect with us on Deep Fried Bites. We love to connect with the community, get feedback, hear your thoughts, comments, questions, queries, and, of course, posers. That's it, folks. We'll see you next time.
See ya.